comes up.
We'll call the Health and Human Services Division to order for Wednesday, April 10th. We have a small number of bills today. Most of them will go fast, but we have several sections of the governor's budget bill to get through today as well. That'll take up a fairly sizable portion of our time. With that, again, we're the finance division. I'm going to make the same reminder I make every meeting if testifiers can try to focus on the finance aspects of the bills before them and limit themselves to 2 to 3 minutes per testifier. We have a very, very large number of bills to get through. We need to do it. We've already added a Saturday hearing. Saturday will be our last day for hearing bills, and then we will begin constructing the delete everything to be added to Senate File 1034 that will be Senate's Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. So with that, Senate File 110, Senator Newman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm going to do my very best to be succinct and keeping in mind the size of your calendar. Mr. Chairman, members, the first thing, if I may, you should have in your packet an A1 amendment. If I could ask someone to offer that for me so I could get the bill in the correct order.
I don't see. You have an amendment?
That's an A1 amendment.
It's being passed out right now.
Do you know about this amendment? Yeah, it's just making it work.
Okay. Staff tells me this amendment just makes it work.
That is correct.
This is an author's amendment. It's the first hearing of Senate File 110. Senator Sharon moves the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill, first of all, is in the House, Mr. Chairman, as a separate bill. It is going to the floor. I'm not sure what your pleasure is in terms of this bill. I would have no objection whatsoever if it goes to the floor as a separate bill and we could take it up there. And after the testimony, we could make the appropriate motion. Mr. Chairman, Senate File 110 involves a nursing home facility affiliated with the Glencoe Hospital out in Glencoe, Minnesota, and we are here for the purpose of correcting an inadvertent error on the part of DHS regarding certain construction project and whether or not the Glencoe Regional Health Services is qualified for a rate increase once the project was completed. I have with me the president and CEO of the facility out in Glencoe, seated immediately to my right, that can address the issue in more specificity. I also have seated to my left Mr. LaBelle with DHS, who would be in a position to answer any questions that you may have. But in a nutshell, what we are doing is correcting an error. I would also indicate to the members that there is a fiscal note, I hope, is in your packet.
It is in our packet, Senator.
And the fiscal note is coming out at zero impact because if I understand correctly, the cost of the rate increase is covered by unallocated funds that are already counted as being spent in the forecast. With that, Mr. Chairman, I will turn the testimony over to the CEO from Glencoe.
Mr. Brabrand, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record in case I butchered it.
Thank you. My name is John Brabrand, President and CEO of Glencoe Regional Health Services. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. You should have a copy of my planned testimony in front of you. I'm going to defer reading that and basically just briefly state what the issue is, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Tabell from DHS. We, as a nursing home, we have a 110-bed nursing home. In order to, there's an avenue for nursing homes in Minnesota to ask for incorporation of construction costs if we do a qualifying project. We asked DHS if we qualified for that. We're told yes. We did the project, turned in our our bill, if you will, and then we're subsequently told, no, there was an error made, we were not eligible. And then there was no administrative remedy, and we're told we'd have to seek a legislative remedy, so that's why we're here today. Just want to state for the record that the Mr. Tabell and Assistant Commissioner Lauren Coleman have been very accommodating, very upfront in acknowledging our predicament. We appreciate their assistance in getting us here today and appreciate Senator Newman's sponsorship. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but I'll just turn over to Mr. Tabell.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Braben. Mr. Tabell, did you have testimony to add? I mean, it is our understanding that this was an inadvertent issue and that the costs are available in the forecast to cover this and one in a Hastings nursing home as well, that there's two of these property facility rates that can be fit within the forecast from errors in last couple of years. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Greg Tabell from the Department of Human Services. Yes, Mr. Chair, that is correct. Mr. Braben did state things accurately. There was a mistake made. I gave them some bad information, and they went and did a project based on that information. And then we found out they were not eligible for the rate increase.
So this corrects that. Any questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify either in support or in opposition to Senate File 110? Seeing none, Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 110, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank
Mr.
you,
Chairman,
Senator
members,
Newman.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Members, there is another that same issue in the Hastings nursing home should be up later in the day. Senator Sieben will be arriving, and it'll be the same issue, just as a heads up for organizational purposes. But with that, we'll move on to Senator Sharon, Senate File 159.
With your permission, Senator Lurie, may I take Senate File 588 first? It is the next.
Senator Sharon, Senate File 588.
Thank you, Senator Lurie and members of the committee. This is a bill that I think many of you have heard either in health policy or judiciary, so if you're not on either of those committees, you may not have heard. This is a bill that has resulted as a result of a lot of work over the interim with all of the licensing boards who've been working independently over a period of time to figure out how to improve their background checks and their processes to make certain when they're issuing licenses that the persons they're issuing licenses to are safe and are able for that licensing agency to assure the public as best they can that this person not only is qualified in terms of their training and their background, but also they meet the standards that you can check out in a background check, so that the care of the persons often that are vulnerable and dependent on the caregiver are in as safe a situation as possible. So this bill, the bill that I had in front of the committee last year was simply for the nurses, but there were other bills that came forward about background checks from several groups, and so the request came from judiciary to try to integrate that to develop a singular approach and policy for all of the boards for licensing, and that is what this bill is about. It's been heard in both policy and judiciary, and we're here today because of the finance issues that are in this bill. And that's really all we're here to speak to, unless somebody else has another question, and then Shirley Brecken would answer any specific details. The important thing for you to note is that these boards collect fees, licensing fees, that go into a special fund. It is out of that fund that the costs that are associated with this bill will be paid, so there is not an impact on this on your budget that you'll be preparing, Senator Lurie. With that, I'll offer Shirley Brecken up for questions.
Right. Ms. Brecken, did you have testimony to add? Or?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Sharon is correct. The funds would come from the Special Government Revenue Fund, which is where the fees are deposited, and none of the boards implementing the criminal background checks will have to raise fees to cover the costs.
Mm-hmm. And have... Right. And you're and adding 2.5 FTEs to fulfill this function, and that's the large, that's the lion's share of the cost.
Mr. Chair, that's correct, along with the one-time costs for the technology changes that would have to be made to for the database to accommodate it.
Senator Kiffmeyer, did I see you had a question?
I think, Mr. Chairman, I think that Section 3 answered my question. The other thing, though, was on line 2.4 and 5, it says, in this or any other jurisdiction, but that's a policy question. I can ask that later. I don't have to ask it as a finance committee.
It must be raising.
Okay. And this has been brought up. I recall vividly all of our discussions regarding a consolidated approach to background checks and really appreciate all the work that was done over the interim to bring a consolidated package forward, and thank you for that. And to your question is a policy-related one. More in the Judiciary Committee. Did you want to ask it now?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't serve on those committees, so that's always a challenge when the bill comes for the first time. But I think it is not essential, this particular one. But Ms. Brecken and I, through the Sunset Commission, Senator Sharon, we did have many hours of conversation about this. I know this represents a great deal of work, so I have a lot of confidence in that, and the rest I'll save for an offline question. Thank you.
Okay, Senator Kiffmeyer. Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to comment there's a lot of email traffic about ban the box. People seeing that, and how would this relate, which is a bill to take off of all applications the issue, have you been convicted of a felony?
Senator Claussen, I have seen those emails. I don't think this really is directly related to ban the box. That's for...
It's not, but I think I'm just kind of bringing up the point that there is a relationship between the bills. If that bill's passed, I assume it would have an effect upon this requirement?
You know, even if there were a box, if there's a box or not a box to check regarding criminal background, the background studies don't really rely on self-reporting of this. The background studies are going to be done by an independent entity for these licensed,
licensed
services that work with vulnerable populations and populations that we have a public interest in protecting and making sure that those that are serving in those capacities don't have these issues. So regardless of whether there's a box or not on that application, this process would call for the background checks when they're appropriate.
It's for all applicants. Thank you.
Yeah, you're absolutely. Any other questions of members? Seeing none, anyone in the audience care to testify either in support or opposition to Senate File 588? And Senator Sharon, you had no amendments or anything to offer? Any other last words? Seeing none, Senator Sharon moves Senate File 588 be recommended to pass. And then these are, and laid over for possible inclusion.
That's correct.
Because we do track these costs in our spreadsheet. Yes, that is the motion. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Sharon.
Thank you.
Ready for your next?
Yes, this is Senate File 159.
Okay.
I'd like to invite Devin Nelson from Cottonwood County and Barb Christensen from Nicola County to the table. Uh, Thank you. I do have an amendment. So do you want me to explain the bill and then introduce the amendment? Because this has been heard in other committees.
Why don't you offer the amendment since it looks like we've been handed a preliminary fiscal note that was drafted to the amendment.
That's correct.
Why don't you offer the amendment at this point?
Okay, I'd like to offer the A3 amendment to Senate File 159.
And that's being handed out, it appears. Okay. Go ahead and describe the amendment, Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much. This bill that's in front of you is an effort on the part of two counties to create an additional exception for how these ICFDD beds are treated and paid for. The goal of the
That's
bill...
That's an intermediate care facility for the developmentally disabled.
Yes,
folks,
yes.
Track.
and I think that it might be best if I have those who are here to meet with you from Southern Minnesota, since they made the trip, be able to talk to you about it a little better. But in essence, what the proposal does is transfer a bed from Cottonwood County, that's over here in Devon, to Nicollet County. This is Barb Christensen from Nicollet County. The bed that is in Cottonwood County, it would reduce the number. It's a 21-bed facility and would reduce their beds. And it would increase an opportunity in Nicollet County to develop a facility that already has four beds, but this bed would increase the number to five beds, which is the number that they need in order for the project to be successful. The movement from Cottonwood County to Nicollet County on the Nicollet side does not have an implication for this committee to consider. But a part of the proposal from Cottonwood County is then to, and that's what the amendment really is about, is to change the total payment rate and establish it at $282.62 per day for the remaining beds. And that, in essence, is what the proposal is about, for them to continue to accomplish the goals that they have for their facility in Cottonwood County. They're willing to make this transition, which occurs. The need is there because of the moratorium on these beds, but you can transfer these beds, and there are exceptions for that, which is what this is about, an additional exception that we're required to come before you in request.
And Senator Sharon, it's actually decertifying three beds in Cottonwood County, so it's not a transfer of just one bed.
Correct.
So it'll go from a 21-bed facility to an 18-bed facility, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And you had some testifiers?
Yes, I would invite both Ms. Christensen, maybe Barb, you could talk about what it is you're trying to accomplish in Nicollet County, then we can talk about what Cottonwood is trying to accomplish in the partnership that's been developed here to accomplish these objectives.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Christensen. State your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning. I'm Barb Christensen. Thank you for allowing us to speak with you today. With the moratorium and with our service that we would like to provide to the difficult situations that families and children run into when trying to find services in our area, we do not have an intermediate care facility for children in our immediate area. So when we run into situations that are complicated for families and they're not able to get the service to keep their children in the home, we have to go so far away to support our children. We have to look for homes 2 to 3, 4 hours away, and so it's really difficult for families to stay connected with their children. So we had this opportunity when we closed. We're trying to use existing resources. We understand that new development is costly and difficult, So we worked with DHS when we closed one of our intermediate care facilities for adults and downsized that to one waiver spot to look at utilizing the resources for this children's site. And with looking at the fiscal piece of it, we just couldn't do it with our provider for only four beds. So we were encouraged to look for additional beds. And I searched all around the state for about 6 months to try to find someone willing to give us a bed from their site that they weren't using. Home for Decayed Living was willing to do that, but they just couldn't do it on their end without some assistance as well. So we're really trying hard to work together regionally to support our adults and our children and use existing resources to the best of our ability.
Thank you, Ms. Christensen.
And then Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Devin Nelson. I'm the administrator of Home for Creative Living in Windham, Minnesota. And as Barb said, we are currently licensed as a 21-bed facility for adults and children. And we felt that if we could downsize to 18, the reason we went with 18 rather than just simply one bed is that it would allow us to get away from shared bedrooms and the home for the folks that are living there, and we thought it would be more viable in the future. And the reason that there's a preliminary, I guess the fiscal note would show that we are looking for an adjustment to our rate to cover the fixed costs that would remain regardless of our capacity. So that's in a nutshell what we're attempting to do.
Which is something along the lines of the planned closure rate adjustments that are done in other types of facilities. Is that correct?
I believe so. We would actually transfer one bed to Nicola County, and then two beds would be decertified, no longer be in the state system.
Senator Benson, you had a question?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I was just asking about the $282.62 per bed per day and where that came from, and I think you indicated that was a planned closure rate. Could somebody help me out? I haven't got a lot of background on this.
Yeah, I believe somebody from DHS might be able to shed some light on how, or maybe Senator Sharon, do you have?
Mr. Nelson can answer your question.
Yeah, I can speak
Mr.
to the
Nelson.
Question. Okay. The rate that we're proposing is we looked at our current cost overall as a 21-bed facility, and we were able to make some reductions in number of staff and some of the other fixed costs. Going down to 18, some of the cost, but not all. So the rate that we're looking for, while it is higher than the current rate, it actually reflects cost savings if you look at 21 beds times the current rate and 18 times bed times the proposed rate. We were able to cut some costs out of there. So it, yes, it is higher than the current, but that is just too because it's spread among fewer individuals at the home.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Senator Benson, did that answer your question?
Yes, and I'm looking at more detail in the fiscal note to see how it was developed. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep. Other questions of members? Seeing none. Senator Sharon?
Thank you. I'd like to move Senate File 159 as amended, and it being laid on the table for possible inclusion. Is that correct?
We didn't adopt your A3 amendment, I guess, yet. So Senator Sharon first moves her A3 amendment to make it work. All those in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
And now I'll move.
And then let me first ask if there's anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either in support or opposition to Senate File 159. And seeing none. Senator Sharon moves Senate File 159 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, same sign. Thank you, Senator Sharon. Motion prevails. So as I mentioned earlier, we're going to be taking up Senate File 1034, the governor's budget proposal, sections of it. I'll come up for that. When Senator Sieben comes, we will probably lay Senate File 1034 on the table and accommodate her with her Dakota County nursing facility. But with that, I'll go up to the table. Yeah, and the there's a handout being distributed right now to members to give you the index of the issues that we will be covering today on Senate File 1034.
Whenever you're ready,
Senate File 1034, and you know, the first item on the handout is the child care licensing changes. I want to assure members we've actually already covered that, and we're not going to talk about swaddling again today. We're going to cross that one out. And also on the handout, down at the bottom of that first block, the application fee for provider screening has already been covered as well, so we're going to cross that one out. And at the very end, budget page 131, the ACA appeals increase. There's no language associated with it, and it has already been covered as well. So with that, I'm going to introduce the Inspector General at DHS, Jerry Kerber, to step through the balance of these items in the Operations Division.
Mr. Kerber, state your name for the record. Welcome again to the committee.
Chair members, my name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the head of the Inspector General's Office at the Department of Human Services. And I'll go through these in the same order they appear on your handout. The first one is, and to some extent we've mentioned these a bit in this committee before, and so I'll give an overview of these, and then to the extent that there are questions or there's an interest in more detail, I have some other folks with me here who can come up and get into more of the detail. The first one is the background studies issue, and there are really two provisions to this.
Madam Chair, it's on page 114 of the governor's recommendations. You'll find that again on the left-hand side to orient members. You'll find the budget page on the left-hand side of the title of the proposal that we're going through, and on the right-hand side you can find the article and section numbers if you want to dig into the large bill.
Thank you, Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair and members, the issue with the background studies is related to a federal grant that was received by the Department of Human Services that is established really to expand and modify the way we do background studies. We do about 270,000 background studies a year, about 1,100 a day on people who work in healthcare and human services throughout the state. The federal government is looking at and projecting that they're going to be making some changes required of states for long-term care in future years, but prior to the requirement, they offered grants to states to get their systems modified. We applied for that grant, and we received $3 million, the maximum. And so we're moving forward on making some changes to our system. We'll be back next year with a lot more proposed changes to our system. But there are a couple of things that we can do this year that we're hoping that are actually required in the grant. The first is to establish a system that's sometimes referred to as wrapback. And what it is, this is going to have the Department of Human Services establish a different relationship with the Minnesota Court Information System, MINSIS, whereas we're on each day we're going to be getting new criminal history information on people that's entered by the courts throughout the state. We are going to filter out the information on people that are not the subject of our background studies and allow through only criminal history information on people who we have done a study on. And in that way, and then we'll review that to see if the people need to be disqualified according to our current law. What we're hoping to do with that is decrease the need to keep repeating background studies on the same people. What we're doing when we repeat a background study is we check again to see if something new has been added to their criminal record. And so what this is going to do is that the system, the criminal justice system, will essentially be informing us of the new information that's added to somebody's record. And so that's the first provision in here. And the second one is expanding our background studies that we do to include access to the BCA's Predatory Offender Registry. In many states, it's called the Sex Offender Registry, but in Minnesota, we have a couple additional crimes that will get somebody on that list, like kidnapping, for instance. And so under the federal requirement, we also have to be checking to see if people are on states' sex offender registries. Ultimately, we'll be looking at that information nationally. But it does make sense for us to look at it in Minnesota, because if somebody moves here from another state and they have committed no crime in Minnesota and we have no reason to believe that they have a criminal record, they may have moved here from, say, Tennessee, where they're a registered sex offender, and they're totally compliant with the registration requirements and they register in Minnesota. And so they are a registered sex offender living in Minnesota, and when we do our background study, we may not see that. The state of Wisconsin and the state of Illinois did some audits, and they found that there were many cases where they had issued family child care licenses to homes where they also had registered sex offenders living. And we did one audit a while back, and we found that we didn't have any, but we really kind of need this in place to make sure we don't set that up. So those are those two provisions, and even though they're in the budget bill and they are going to cost us some money, there's not any kind of line item for this because it's being paid for with the federal grant. But because there's a cost, they ended up here.
And Senator Lurie?
And on this, too, we should note that it was flagged that this is a significant change in judiciary issues. And so what we did to make sure that we had a judiciary review of this is we drafted it as a separate bill. I believe it's scheduled
tomorrow
to be heard tomorrow in judiciary. So we're going to keep working through this. It won't even wind up on our table until we're done going through all of the provisions of Senate File 1034. And judiciary will have their ability to review the policy and make sure that they're going to sign off on this. And we will, on a policy basis, track whatever changes they make. But on a budgetary basis, for purposes of our committee, it is paid for with the federal grant.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Lurie, Mr. Kerber, that federal grant, I see, is through, it says 2015 and thereafter. We have been assured that, obviously, that there will be continued support from the feds on this. And does the judiciary branch, do they, not probably judiciary, but maybe the courts branch, do they have to show this also on their budget? Is there any expense out of their pocket? Like you said, there is expense out of DHS.
Senator Lurie or Mr. Kerber?
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, that's a really good question. Actually, the Minnesota Court Information System already has a process set up where people can subscribe to the service where you get this information on a regular basis. So they're not really having to change much. The changes that have to be done are really kind of on our end because we don't want all their information. And so we could subscribe today to get all new criminal history information that's added to their system. And, you know, that's not what we're interested in. So they're really and they do that today for free. So there really is no cost on their end. To the extent that there might be little tweaks and things like that, I mean, we've been working with them, and they've assured us that this is something that's very doable without them having a fiscal note. I might add one thing here, too, as Senator Lurie said. I mean, this is an important change that's going to be reviewed by judiciary. And certainly we understand that some of the other changes that we'll be proposing next year and the year after are going to be very significant because what we're moving towards is requiring fingerprints on everybody we do a background study on. And while in some other states that hasn't been really a big deal, we anticipate that there will be some concern about that in Minnesota. You know, when we are starting to ask for fingerprints on everybody, there are a lot of good questions about what are we doing with those? Are we storing them? How long are we keeping them? What else are they going to be used for? And so we will be having those conversations certainly next year, I'm sure, in full. And they may, we recognize that they may impact whether or not we continue going forward with the federal grant. There are some significant policy decisions to be made. But these two this year are kind of what we're going forward with now.
Thank you, Mr. Kerber.
The second item, Madam Chair and members, relates to our child care provider fraud investigations. This is not, again, related to swaddling or pacifiers, but this is really related to the child care assistance program, where what we're seeking to do is to establish an investigative function within the Department of Human Services, where there really is none now. There's $418 million is going to be spent in the child care assistance program. This year there's 12,500 providers who are enrolled, but yet there's over 6,000 families on a waiting list to get sliding fee assistance. And over the years, from coming at this from the licensing end, we've seen some things that appear to be red flags in our licensing work in child care, in that there are very poor records regarding, for instance, the children who are in attendance, poor records regarding staff and qualifications. We've also been kind of wondering, well, what are we paying for in these programs? And it's not unusual for us to be paying significant child care assistance to the providers themselves. And so one of the things that's really a benefit, I think, of this new Inspector General's office is that we are combining the licensing functions with fraud investigation functions into one unit. And so what this is kind of the natural next step here is to create an administrative investigative function for the child care assistance program. What we have in place now is we have we give grants to counties out there to do investigations of recipient fraud for child care assistance. But there is no function in government that looks at provider, maybe provider collusion even on some of these cases. There are, if it rises to the level of being a criminal activity, then we can try to get county attorneys to become involved and have law enforcement investigation. But between those, and those decisions tend to get influenced by the severity of the crime and the amount of money involved. But on our end, we see that we have a responsibility really to monitor this more closely. And so this unit would be created for that function. And while there is a cost the first couple years, the money we intend to recover won't totally pay for the cost of the program. When we get into the second biennium, we do see a return on investment that supports it.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kerber, so is this preemptive analytics or is this a pay-and-chase model?
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, you know, we're really hoping for both, and at the same time, certainly we have had concerns brought to our attention, and we have a hotline, and, you know, we will continue to get complaints, and we'll continue to get referrals from licensing folks and from county folks and you know, and neighbors call us. Certainly we're going to be doing some of that chase, but at the same time we want to be a little bit smarter also in looking at the data, and that's why we've got a couple of FTEs in here for data analytics so that we can find it ourselves. Now that is to some extent still chasing, but one of the things that this office is also charged with is when we're doing this investigative work and we're finding that there are problems in our programs, we should be looking at really how do these problems occur and how can we make changes to our programs to decrease the likelihood of further fraud cases.
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Kerber, in welfare fraud and Medicaid fraud, other states have done this. Is there a model that you have seen and are going to be following or improving on?
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, in fact, yes, Wisconsin went through a period where the media had been doing their own investigations and found, and you know, they uncovered a significant amount of what appeared to be fraud in their child care assistance program. And it was certainly, we believe, far more widespread than what we have in Minnesota. But we have met with them, and we've reviewed their program. And our proposal here is quite a bit more modest. I think they were looking at expanding. I think they increased like 40 positions to just kind of blanket the state with this investigative activity. You know, we're looking more conservatively here. We're looking at a total of 6 people who are going to be doing the investigation work itself, actually 4 doing investigations, 2 doing data analytics, and then there's a couple of FTEs in here for the licensing work because these programs that we think are those that are most likely to be engaged in this activity also have licensing issues concurrently. And so we want to have kind of a full approach to this activity. But it's much more conservative than what we've seen in Wisconsin. And what we're hoping to do is to see, you know, find what we can find and then come back and report back on what kind of activity we were able to discover, what kind of recoveries we're able to get. And if there's a good basis for expanding this program to be, you know, as large as Wisconsin, then we'll certainly be asking for that. But we don't know that yet.
And Senator Benson. Madam Chair, Mr. Kerber, looking, I'm not seeing any IT appropriation in here.
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, that's a good point. I think we're planning on that within the data analytics components of the proposal, but there isn't a specific line item for that. You're right.
Thank you, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Cooper. It says too on the first paragraph, the total net investment for this proposal, including recoveries and savings, in addition to federal matching funds. Where are the federal matching funds?
There's in the child care assistance program, there's TANF money.
Okay, the TANF.
And so when we talk about the recoveries we have here, some of the recoveries will be to the general fund. Some of them, 50% of our recoveries go right back into the fund, right back into themselves to help that over 6,000 waiting families. But so it's that TANF money. Madam Chair, I'll proceed. The next one on our list here is the expansion of surveillance and integrity review division. And this is on your summary sheet here. Something that's not quite correct. This is not one that required language in the bill. What this is related to is our current SIRS investigation unit, our surveillance and integrity review, where we investigate Medicaid overpayments in providers. And what we're looking at here is simply expanding the number of people that we have to do that. There's over 800,000 people are receiving services. 154,000 healthcare providers are enrolled of 78 different types, and $8.6 billion a year is paid in the fee for service program. But yet we have 10 investigators, and currently, there's a pretty good investment, return on investment with those investigators. Each of them today, we're focusing on the big ticket items as much as we can. And there's a recovery of somewhere in the vicinity of about $500,000 per investigator. We didn't project quite that amount of savings here, but we're proposing an addition of 6 investigators in that area. And we're projecting some pretty good recoveries. The next one,
maybe before we move on, that was all of Article, Madam Chair, that was all of Article 5. Maybe we want to open it up. I don't know if there's members of the public who wish to testify on some of these provisions in Article 5.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen?
I'm still on the expansion of surveillance and integrity review. I'm sorry, Senator Lurie.
No, that's fine.
But there are 6 FTEs that are being recommended with only a savings of $668,000. Are those low projections, Mr. Kerber, would you say?
Mr. Kerber.
It sounds like we're just kind
Madam
of...
Chair and Senator Rosen, we think so. I mean, that's after the costs. So that's after we pay for the 6 FTEs. This is how much is going to be contributed back to the general fund. And it's also taking out the federal share. So there's, you know, it's really kind of double. We have to give half of what we recover back to CMS. And so this would be the state share for that. And we think it's low, but part of what we do, you know, when we're investigating some of these, there isn't always a whole lot of money involved, but we certainly want to go after the principal as well. So some of these smaller operations, personal care provider organizations that are engaged in some pretty significant false billing, we still want to go after those and investigate those and administer these consequences and recover that money back. But it may not, these are conservative numbers. We're expecting it to be a little bit more, but this is, you know, we didn't want to overstate it.
Then, Madam Chair, Mr. Kerber, and then in 2016-17, you're requesting another six and six?
No.
Just
Madam
six?
Chair.
Okay.
Same.
Just,
no.
All right.
Same six.
Thank you.
Senator Benson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kerber, this looks to me like an enhancement of your current pay and chase model. Is there something I'm missing? Are you getting more front-end and analytics? I know we had a hard time recapturing the benefits of front-end prevention. We count the recovery. So can you please explain that?
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, I think this is, you know, this is kind of on its face some more pay and chase. But as I mentioned, one of the things that is sort of it's a charge of this office, this Inspector General's office, is to sort of begin looking at those situations and looking for trends and looking at those risks, identifying risks against our programs, and then using that information to inform future policy changes. And so it's not the end of the story. It is certainly chasing that money to get it back appropriately, but hopefully we're going to be using more information to feed back into the front end.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kerber, when we were going through some of the analytics bills last year, we couldn't count any savings and were told by the department that because our audit division is already one of the best in the country, the department didn't see any actual savings from doing preventive analytics. But now you're coming back and saying with just a few more auditors, we're going to have significant savings. And so I'm having a little trouble reconciling those two things. If we are the best in the country and there's no savings from preemptive work, how can we be counting savings now?
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, I'm not so sure about the best in the country part of it, but I think when we talk about the audit work up front, you know, so there's two different sort of chunks of work here. There's auditing to make sure the programs are implemented correctly, and then investigating after the fact to see whether or not people overbilled anyway. The audit work it's difficult to identify savings in that area because as we find a problem with the program, people who are who are eligible for services should be going to a different provider. If we find that there's a problem with the program, we fix that problem, and then from there on, the program is operating as it ought to be. It's hard to catalog sort of what the savings are. If we hadn't intervened, you know, what would we have continued to spend? And then what do you do with that money? Is it really available, or is it money for something else, or is it available for the recipients who are eligible in the first place? So there's the program, and there's the eligibility of the individuals, and the two get intertwined a little bit differently. In our case, investigating after the fact and looking at inappropriate billing, it's a little bit easier to identify, in some ways, a savings and a recovery. Because maybe not so much a savings, but a recovery, because we're able to identify that there was some either a service that was billed that was not provided, or it was provided in a way that didn't match the requirements.
And Madam Chair and Mr. Kerber, I understand the difference. My challenge is last year we were told already doing this, really good at it. Don't know that there's a lot left to get here. Was the message I clearly got. And now we're saying there's going to be significant savings. And the other point, Minute moved 600 DHS staff. Now we're adding back six. Is it your opinion that Minute took staff that were appropriately working on audit functions?
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, these aren't really the same staff, and the Minutes staff that kind of were essentially removed from some of what our control is, are still sitting there. They have a different organizational structure they answer to, but you know I still see them, and we still work together on a lot of these projects. So it's not like they're totally removed from us, and we'll continue to be working together. But so I know that there was a shift in funding streams as well. But what we're talking about here is not the same type of work as was in Minutes.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Kerber, I acknowledge they're still sitting there, but the fiscal note seems to imply that because the 600 staff were moved to minutes organizational chart, that you need six more FTEs. That's the implication. And so I'm asking if Minute took your auditors, because if they're not related, then let's not have it in here. Let's not talk about the 600 staff being moved. If you just need five more people, I'm sorry.
Madam
Chair,
let's not talk about it.
Senator Benson, we're having trouble tracking exactly where you're...
I'm sorry. I'm on page 108.
Oh, we're on...
This would be one.
Expansion
we're
of
on
internal,
page 110. I'm sorry.
Expansion of internal audit capacity. Oh, expansion of surveillance. Well, I apologize.
Okay,
Mr.
so we were
Kerber,
talking.
No wonder there were six and five. I still do have a question about that part, but if we're not, if we've already covered it, then I'm stuck back further than you were. Sorry, Mr. Kerber. I still do have questions about how you're going to count savings when we have one of the best pay and chase systems in the country, but I'll have no more questions at this point.
Thank you, Senator Benson. Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Kerber. I was wondering about where we reached the point of diminishing returns and how far we'd have to go before we reach that point. Has there been any assessments done to calculate how much would have to be done to squeeze out every dollar that we could possibly save before it starts costing more, and how far this gets us to that point? And I have one more question.
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair and Senator Eakin, I think that's a good point. And it's certainly something that we need to pay attention to. I think we're still projecting that for every investigator we add to the fraud investigative function, there's going to be a return. Hopefully we get to the point where we're confident that we're getting a handle on it and we're able to recover everything there is to recover. But more importantly, and kind of following Senator Benson's inquiry here, ideally, we ought to be moving upstream a little bit and decreasing the need for so many investigations and getting away as far as we can from the pay and chase and preventing the inaccurate payments in the first place. I mean, that's really the ultimate goal we ought to have here, just like anything if we're investigating alleged maltreatment that we'll talk about next. I mean, ideally, we're going to be doing some things to prevent it from occurring in the first place so we don't spend so much money investigating it after that. But so I don't think we're there yet, but it's certainly something we have to keep talking about.
Okay. Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was wondering, too, you'd mentioned that half the money that's recovered does go back to the federal government, but it's the state that's picking up the cost of the surveillance completely. I was wondering if or does the Fed have to pick up some of those costs as well?
Madam Chair,
Senator Eakin, Mr. Kerber.
When for these general fund appropriations, there is a federal match, and so there is a and I can't remember really. It's like 35% match, I think,
on
this.
Most of them. Yeah.
So they are paying for some of this. So you know, for every if we ask for $100, 35 of those dollars comes from the federal government to reimburse the general fund, and so it's really only the other 65 that's coming out of the general fund.
Okay. But if you, Madam Chair, if you
Senator
can imagine
Hayden,
from the
Senator.
Fed's perspective, you know, we're administering the shared state and federal program, and if we've administered it in a manner that allows fraud, I mean, we find that fraud, they support us in finding it, but they need their 50 cents that they pay, that they contributed to that fraudulent payment back, you know. So I mean, they are supporting us. We get a benefit too from finding it, both in terms of just program integrity as well as the financial aspects of it.
Senator Sharon.
Yes, I'm sorry, but I'm just not clear yet if there's not an answer, or you know, I think both Senator Benson and Senator Eakin in their own way are asking a question that we've asked many, many times, not just last year, and that is, at what point does the investment in chasing dollars outweigh the amount you're spending way more money chasing down very little return? And I don't know if we have a measure. We're expanding here, and it is true that we have really heard that we're at that in the past, at least we've been at that point where our collections and our return on fraudulent payments is very good, and the system is working and doesn't need expansion. So there, it is confusing to me also to hear this message to expand this program now, unless we're targeting a different group than we've been talking about in the past in terms of fraud investigation.
Senator Lurie?
You know, a couple of comments. I mean, there does become a point of diminishing returns. We worked through this in the Department of Revenue. You know, we added some investigators there a few years ago. It's worked well. You know, but your return on investment diminishes as you add more and more. You know, one of the points that I think I would like to make is on page 110 that we were talking about. Mr. Kerber mentioned we're talking about an $8.6 billion program with 10 investigators. We're talking about adding six and generating, you know, $700,000 in savings. It is a small percentage, but for program integrity, for the trust of the public, openness, accountability, it's still worth going after that, but it is a very small percentage. Some of the other proposals that have been before us have been to, you know, bring in private vendors with, you know, sophisticated tools to change from the pay and chase. And I think those often can add a great deal of value, but I think it's also important to understand that here, too, we're still talking about a very small percentage. It's not, you know, a huge bang for the buck, but people really are looking for the openness and the accountability and the trust in our public systems that we are going after everything that we can, even when it's not, these aren't huge percentages that we're going to be finding.
Senator Lurie, I see that Senator Sieben's here. Would we want to pause at this time and come back to this section? Or I know Senator Kiesmeyer,
you know, I think
Meyer
we're probably, maybe we could finish this one section and then lay 1034 over. Is that?
Yeah. At least Senator Kiesmeyer has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Lurie. I think one of the things that the other sense of the timing of doing this when there was an interest before and it wasn't well received, and so now it seems as though this has more legs to it. The big thing in regards to this is that the return to the fund looks lower because of the federal government payback plus the costs for the investigators on top of that. But the big thing for me is that when you return this to the fund, it helps to reduce the waiting list. So it feeds right back into serving those, and that's the issue with fraud. It takes money from those who would otherwise rightly need it or rightly get it. So I appreciate that. This is focused, though. I looked at several of the pages, though, on the providers. Is there also an equal effort for those who are getting the child care benefits and are fraudulently asking for it? I mean, is there a side of that as well, Mr. Kerber?
Mr. Kerber?
Madam Chair and Senator Kiesmeyer, yes. Right now we issue grants to counties that do investigations of recipient fraud, so people who are misrepresenting their eligibility, for instance. And there's about 600 to 700 of those investigations that are completed a year and about $600,000 to $700,000 in overpayments identified. Those are tough to collect on, but there is that activity. What we've seen with the child care assistance is that there's been a big gap in the system in that there is no administrative investigative function related to child care providers. It's only recipients and then criminal investigation. And there's no administrative layer in here for somebody to take a look at how is this program being violated perhaps by those that were enrolling in the child care assistance program. So it's filling a gap.
Senator Kiesmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, Mr. Kerber, I would say then also your comments in regards to the analytics, as you said, recoveries always take a lot of effort, cost money, and take time. So if we can upfront make sure that those who are qualified as recipients, providers as well, and I would expect, though, at some point that this would help you to develop ways of doing this, because many times when you do an investigation, you discover the spots that are allowing them to either receive or provide or whichever part of it, you know, where is that? Do you also look for those, bring legislative changes or system changes or process changes as well so that we help prevent?
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, I think you're going to be seeing a lot more of that from us. This office is really charged with that, and there really wasn't an entity within the agency that had that specific responsibility. Mm-hmm. Okay. The other thing I might just add is that we are under a new requirement from CMS to do risk assessments of our implementation of the federal programs. And so those are beginning, and they're underway, and we're participating in that. And certainly what we're bringing to the discussion are the results of our investigations that show these are the kinds of things that demonstrate how our system lacked the program integrity and that lacked the controls that allowed this kind of thing to occur. And in this risk assessment process, and that, you know, that will inform future initiatives that we have, certainly, to tighten up our programs in the appropriate way. There's always a balance, you know, because we don't want to make it harder for people, you know, for people who are legitimately in need of this, of these programs, to get the resources they need. And we want to make sure providers who are stepping up provide these valuable services aren't overly burdened. But we do need to do it smarter in some of these ways where we are really in putting integrity in the program, you know, program integrity, even for the sake of the integrity itself. You know, I mean, we are answerable to the public, all of us.
Thank you. Yeah, Madam Chair, and just a quick comment. I think it works both ways. One, you keep out the fraud, but also those who are entitled or eligible or rightly qualified, it will also speed up the process generally for them as well. So it can do both things at the same time. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The term the point of diminishing returns has been used many times. Can you define that in this case?
Madam Chair and Senator Claussen, I think probably it would be that point where it's hard to say. I think different people would have different opinions about where that is. But one measure of it would be where we are recovering only as much money as it's cost to recover that money. And so then you wonder, is it worth it to have these state jobs to recover only what it costs to recover the funds? It gets to be a tricky thing. I think we'll have those discussions when we get close to it, or what we believe to be close to it, because we want to believe that there's a deterrent factor in here, too, and that one of the things that we perceive to be the case in child care programs is that there's not much likelihood of there being a consequence for people. At worst, they're going to be told not to do it anymore. And what we want to do is to, you know, get a better oversight system, get a better investigative function in here. And in the language here, we are actually going to be seeking the recovery. Not only did we find that you were billing incorrectly, but you're going to pay it back. And we're going to be doing these investigations in a way that's going to help facilitate some criminal prosecutions, too. You know, because we hear from county attorneys that we've met with that they just don't have really the resources to package up some of these cases for criminal prosecution if they aren't huge, you know. So that's one of our goals here, so that people will perceive there to be an increased likelihood that they're going to be caught and there are going to be consequences. And so that deterrent element is a hard thing to measure. And so I don't think we would want to stop at just saying, you know, for every dollar we're spending on this, we're recovering that dollar back and it's break even. I think we want to sort of recognize that there might be a little bit more here that's unmeasurable, the deterrent factor.
Senator Claussen.
Yeah, thank you. And I assume you'll be analyzing that and sharing that information with us in the future.
Madam Chair, we certainly hope to.
Thank you.
Any other questions from members before we lay the bill aside for the time being and come back to it after Senator Stevens' bill? Senator Sieben. Senate filed 1230. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, and I apologize for the disruption of your going over your other bill because of my tardiness here today. Members, Senate file 1230 is very similar, as I understand, to a bill that you heard earlier today from Senator Newman. And what it does, or the rationale for it, is that Regina Medical Center, which is located in Hastings, is undergoing a three-phase expansion. And unfortunately, prior to the construction beginning, they were given an incorrect, Regina was given an incorrect reimbursement rate information from the Minnesota Department of Human Services. And so this bill attempts to correct that. And with me today to help explain it, the bill, is Greg Tabell from the Department of Human Services. Would you like to go first, Mr. Tabell? And Greg Kopp, who's the CFO of Regina Medical Center. And if Mr. Kopp could please first explain the situation, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Mr. Kopp, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, good morning. My name is Greg Kopp. I'm the CFO for Regina Medical Center. And again, I'll be very brief. During the planning stages of our nursing home construction project, we engaged DHS to help us determine the impact our project would have on the daily component of our property rate. Yeah. Once we completed phase one of our project, we submitted our request to DHS to calculate that rate increase. And that's when we were informed by DHS that we did not qualify for a rate increase due to the inaccurate information they gave us back during that planning phase. DHS has been very supportive and helpful to us during this unfortunate situation, and we appreciate that.
So. Thank you for your testimony. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Greg Tabell from the Department of Human Services. What Mr. Kopp has told you is correct, and you and the committee may be happy to know that these are the only two facilities where this has been a problem.
Thank you, Mr. Tabell. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to check to see if there's some process has been put in place to make sure that this isn't an ongoing problem.
Mr. Tabell.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, yes, we have been talking about that in our division. It stems from going back to information that is years old, and a lot of times the facility does not have that anymore, and well, we have it. We're required to retain it for a number of years. So they would come to us and ask what the numbers are, and I happened to pull a couple of wrong numbers for these facilities. So what we've been talking about now is going through and finding this information for each of the facilities and posting it on our webpage so they can get it themselves and see the numbers and verify them for themselves.
Senator Sieben?
I have nothing further, Madam Chair, unless there are any questions from the committee.
Any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, I entertain a
move that this is one that the last one, Senator Newman's bill, went directly to the floor because in the other body it's already on the floor on second reading. But my understanding is that the House hasn't been able to move this one to the floor just yet, so it's likely to wind up in the omnibus bill. But in case the House decides to move a few things that could just be handled separately, this is one of these dual-track ones. So my motion will be that Senate file to, we didn't have to amend it, did we? Senate file 1230 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance, and that it be laid on the table here for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services omnibus bill.
On Senator Lurie's dual motion, any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Against, no. Motion prevails. And
thank you very much, committee.
Thank you, Senator Sieben, and congratulations on your new baby girl.
Thank you.
After 2 weeks, it's very impressive you're here. So now we're back to Senator Lurie's bill on 1034, and I believe we're on Article 9, unless there's further discussion on Article 5, but I think we are done with that discussion.
Madam Chair, Jerry Kerber again. There was one more item in Article 5.
Go ahead.
At the bottom of the list, Madam Chair, item 111 on the governor's budget pages is also an Article 5 item.
And this is one, Madam Chair and members, the summary that you have was not quite accurate. There is some language for this provision that's in Article 5, Sections 5 and 10. And what this provision follows some of the conversation we were having a moment ago about recoveries. And what we're proposing to do here is three different things related to recovering additional funds when we identify an overpayment. The first one I'll start with is that we had been talking about when we identify overpayments in Medicaid funds, we're responsible for giving the feds back their share. We have to give them back that 50%. However, and we do that. We do that regularly. There is a provision in the federal law that allows us to get that money back from them if we have determined that collecting on getting that recovery from that provider is just not possible. And so we certainly have to make the effort to recover the funds, and we do. But if it's not recoverable, then we can request CMS to give us that money back. And surprisingly, we haven't done that. And so that's one of the things we're going to start doing here. And part of the reason we haven't done it is that there really hasn't been anybody assigned to do that kind of work within our agency. And so we're requesting a couple of FTEs here that are going to focus on that. And so we're going to be recovering some funds there.
Mr. Kerber, what would be the definition of not recoverable? Is there a set guideline from CMS?
Yeah,
can you elaborate?
Madam Chair, it's, you know, some providers go out of business, they leave the state, they leave the country. And there are some guidelines for that, certainly. But when we meet that criteria, then we'll be submitting that request. And so we're anticipating some recovery there. The second one is related to surety bonds. And currently, providers of durable medical equipment providers are required to purchase a surety bond as a condition of enrollment. Currently, the surety bond, however, only lists federal government as a payee should there be an overpayment. And so we're modifying that to say the state also is a payee. And then similarly, for personal care provider organizations, they've been required to purchase surety bonds for some time. And they've been a low amount, however. It's up to $50,000 or 10%, whichever is less. And it didn't matter. Our agency had never collected on any of them. But so this office has started collecting on some of those, and we've collected on two so far. And we saw that, you know, really the structure of that is kind of artificially low. And so we're raising it in the language here to be at least, you know, $100,000 or 10%, whichever is higher. That we want people to have that surety bond. So those are two of them. And then the third area is one that's – there's no language for it, but we're going to be making more referrals to the Department of Revenue for tax liens and things of that nature so that when people owe the state money. So that we're anticipating that we're going to be recovering some money in those areas.
Thank you, Mr. Kerber. Any questions from members in Section 5? Senator Lawrence?
Audience,
anybody wish to testify at this time? Seeing none, I think
yes.
We're...
Yeah.
Yes. Please proceed.
Oh, you know what? This is Section 9, isn't it?
This is Section
Article 5.
Okay, I'm waiting for 43.
Okay.
Sorry.
No
problem. Thank you.
My
apologies. Mr. Kerber?
Okay, Madam Chair, the next one that's in Office of Inspector General is on the budget page 98, and that's related to the home and community-based waiver. I think that the changes that we're pursuing were relative to licensure and fee collection in that area. In kind of a little background, I think the committee has heard some background on this, but in 2007, CMS audited the agency and we had a corrective action plan. Basically, they found that across the disability waivers, the department hadn't done an adequate job of assuring that people in different areas of the state were going to be eligible for the same services for about the same costs, and it was monitored similarly. And that was largely the result of the system that we had in place that allowed counties to negotiate with providers and through the county contracting process that may have been variable throughout the state, and then also the rates were set through that process. So this is part of a two-step process. There's also a rate-setting methodology provision in the bill that is, I think you're going to talk about also, maybe not today. But then this is the part that says that all of these disability waiver services are going to be regulated the same way. And the way they're going to be regulated is through licensure by the state. We have been licensing since the very early 90s the services provided under the DD waiver, under Chapter 245B. But this will repeal Chapter 245B and replace it with 245D. That is one set of licensing standards that will apply across all of the home and community-based services. So to do that, the way our licensing activities are funded these days is through the fees. We recover the actual cost for engaging in this oversight activity. So in the budget, it shows that this will cost us about $4.5 million to do it. 2.7 of it is new money. So the other funds that are in there are money that we've been collecting all along and doing that part of the work. So this has a 12 additional FTEs for the licensing division. 8 of those are maltreatment investigators, and 4 of them are licensing staff. Certainly what we're anticipating is that there's going to be a change in the number of cases that we have to do follow-up investigation on the reporting to us. It may be possible maltreatment. And it's a serious responsibility, and some of those investigations are done now by counties. So County Adult Protection has the burden to investigate those allegations, and that's shifting to the state. And so that's where 8 of these positions are. So, Madam Chair, if there's any other questions about that, I can ask, and we can go into certainly more detail here.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gerber, you're saying shifting to the state. So this is a previous function within the county structure. How many investigators were there in the 87 counties, and now it has changed to all at the state level, or is there some transfer process or change?
Mr. Gerber.
Madam Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, you know, I don't know how many county adult protection workers have been involved in these activities. We don't really know that. Some of these investigations, and I'm not sure if it is knowable, but we can do a little more research on that. What we tried to find out from counties was how many investigations have they done in general. So we got some information from like Hennepin County, where, you know, there's an overrepresentation of some of this maltreatment, because more than half the people in the state getting services are right there. And so we use some of their data to extrapolate and then apply to our own standards. We expect one person to be able to investigate 40 maltreatment cases a year, for instance. So, so there's different layers, there's different types of investigations that are done. These will now be facility-type investigations under the Vulnerable Adult Act that sort of take on a little bit different nature than some of the investigations that may have been done by County Adult Protection. So, for instance, when we do these maltreatment investigations, we have to determine, you know, what did the alleged incident occur? Does it meet the definition of one of the definitions of maltreatment under the statute? If it does, it can be supported by preponderance of evidence. Then if we say, yes, in fact, this did occur and it was maltreatment, then we have to make a determination about who was responsible. Was it the individual, or was it actually the responsibility of the employer because they didn't do adequate oversight, they didn't do adequate training, they didn't have adequate policies and procedures? And so we have to make that judgment call and then issue consequences as a result. So if a facility is responsible for maltreatment, they typically get a fine of $1,000. If an individual is responsible for maltreatment, then it kicks over into our background study law, and we have to evaluate whether or not to disqualify the person from working further. So it's kind of a different thing. And so we didn't spend a lot of time on sort of looking at county resources that had been committed to their doing a standard adult protection type investigation compared to what we will have to do as a facility.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 99, there on down towards the bottom under licensing standards and functions, there's a comment about a $500, not to exceed $500 annually for the county to do a licensing inspection. And one of the concerns that I have is licensing fees or all these kind of things and to recover the costs. Do you, as the Office Inspector General, have any sort of computation of these things so that the concern that I hear from people are that they're charging these fees and padding them to cover other costs, not the actual costs of their own inspection or the inspections of their area? Can you address that subject?
Madam Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer, the $500 fee that you're referencing there is what's been permitted in statute for a few years. And in the world of adult foster care, for instance, there really are two types of foster care. There's what sometimes is referred to as corporate foster care and then family foster care. And so family foster care is essentially that situation where somebody is living their primary residence and they take in another person or two to live with them as a family. The license holder resides in the home. The other model, which is referred to often as corporate foster care, is where the license holder doesn't live in the home. The license holder, you know, maybe owns the home or leases the home, but it's not their primary residence. The people live in the home and there are shift staff that come in. Under the changes here, it's that latter group that gets affected. Because they will then be under a different sort of licensing structure. Currently, they get an adult foster care license the same as sort of the mom-and-pop setting, but there's an opportunity for counties to charge the licensing fee only for those corporate settings. What there's going to be changing a little bit here, and I think we're not proposing a change to that fee here. It's discretionary, and it's up to $500. But the nature of the county's oversight of those settings is going to be a little different too, because what had typically been considered the foster care services in those settings is going to come under this new license, and so the county's inspection of the home is an inspection of the building. You know, it's not looking at the program that's being provided for the people. That will be under the state license. And so the question that's been coming up, and maybe you've had some of this, is should it still cost $500? Are the people at the county going to be the same kind of people at the county who are doing that kind of inspection is going to be doing the inspection of the home? Or is it a different type of county worker? And I think as we kind of roll this out and it goes into effect, you know, January 1st of next year, I think a lot of these things are going to come to light, and, you know, and I'm assuming people are going to be back, and we'll be talking about those issues some more.
Madam Chair, just
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, I just have a concern about this because, especially when you're saying they're going to inspect the structure, I don't know what you need $500 for. And again, it's an up to. I do understand that. But we're seeing a lot of fees and costs and things like this being placed upon them, and yet they are the ones that are caring for the people. So I just want to be sure there is a return on their investment. They are putting money forward to get an inspection or to do something like that, but that it is only for that and not for other things. What my specific question is, do you have some sort of a rate setting to the counties that says, here's the worksheet? You have to say, here's what our costs are before you can justify that fee. In other words, we have other people that have to, as providers, submit this to you and say, here's why we're charging this, because this is what we're all doing. What about the county when they set this fee? Is there a worksheet? Is there an application to you that says, here's our justification for this particular fee to do this particular inspection? Is there anything like that going on?
Mr. Kerber?
Madam Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, you know, there really isn't. And not to say that there shouldn't be. I think what our in this kind of work being done by the counties, the counties have really kind of dealt with the legislature directly. Fees had been prohibited in these programs, and it was counties that brought forth a proposal that they be able to charge a fee, not for the mom-and-pop providers, those that are taking people into their own home with their primary residence, but really for those corporate settings, those businesses that are operating foster care. The counties proposed to the legislature that they be able to charge that fee. And the legislature set the fee at up to $500. And I think there's a provision in there saying that they should be, you know, recover actual costs. So there's sort of a qualifier on there. But our agency hasn't really been involved in that, and that's not to say we shouldn't or couldn't, but we haven't to this day.
And
Senator DeLory?
Madam Chair, to this point, it is, if you want to dig into your big bill, it is on page 267 of the bill, and this has always been there, but as Mr. Kerber stated, it's not necessary. I've heard these same complaints, and it does say, you know, for the purposes of adult foster care and child foster care licensing, that's the existing ability for counties to assess a fee, and it's adding and licensing the physical plant of a community residential setting. Under this chapter, a county may charge a fee to a corporate applicant or corporate license holder to recover the actual cost of licensing inspections. And so we did statutorily limit them to actual costs. You know, there's allegations that counties are going beyond that, and at some point we maybe ought to look at it a little more carefully, but that is not to exceed $500 annually. So, I mean, there is the statutory reference to actual cost.
Madam Chair and Senator Lori, I appreciate that. Those are good intentions and goals and motivations, but it's the old trust and verify. And we're putting a lot of things on our providers and our clients. I think we should just have a similar situation or some sort of programmatic thing that they at least have to be held accountable for that.
Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, I agree, and I wanted to highlight that and point it out for when we get in these conversations, we can also point back to that and continue to work toward a system where there is that accountability and that people are comfortable with the level and that it is actual costs being charged. I mean, I haven't personally dug deep to get an audit of exactly what the county costs are, but we did say that they're supposed to be limited to that. And if, you know, and I do understand that there's, you know, been several licensed facilities who believe that the county is padding, that various counties are padding this, and they should continue to pursue that.
Madam Chair, I just think that's just an equitable situation, and I think that, you know, when you're passing and you're giving them some new authority for this and the fee, that is the better time to say, you know, you need to have a worksheet calculation as part of this to justify your actual costs that would be made available to DHS upon request or something like that. I think the best time to put it in place is when you're actually drafting and giving them it, and instead of waiting for the issues, problems, and then all the costs that go with it. And just a comment, I so appreciate all of these, the budget page proposal and the article and so on. The problem, Senator DeLory, is I don't have a page number, and this is such a giant bill. So to try and even find an article,
you know,
is real
Chair,
hard. If I just might suggest that in the future, those who are maybe putting these together, if you just might add the page. I don't know if that's too hard or too.
Well, actually, it's actually pretty easy on the bottom to the left of the page number is the article and section, and they are in order. And so, if you just flip through, you can actually find article and section rather quickly. And it's.
I've tried, Madam Chair. I've tried, and I've gone through and. This is not just this year. It's any really great big bill, and some articles are short, some long, and I have tried that, and that's the only way.
Okay. I mean, if, Madam Chair, if members...
Is there a code? Okay.
Yeah, there's a code
I'll figure it out,
printed on
Mr.
every
Chair.
Page.
I'll figure
there's
it out.
The article and section number that the page represents, and so if you're not at the article and section yet, keep going if you
right
are.
Right here, Mr. Chair.
No. At the bottom of every page. Just open it up. Page 375 is Article 11, Section 4. If you're looking for something in Article 9, you know it's ahead of that. Go ahead a little ways. You know, there's Article 8. I mean, if you just use your thumb and flip through, it works. And if the page numbers, because we have delete everythings and stuff, it gets really burdensome to try to track the page numbers over time.
That's what I thought. So
article and section number will always be at that thing. And if members want to find a page, I can, you know, just orientation is really important, and I want members to be able to track what we're talking about.
A little staff has helped me with an additional page on the way back that I didn't see, so we're good.
Okay. Good, good.
And Senator Sharon, and I believe Senator Eakin also has questions.
Maybe before we do that, we do have an individual that was here to testify. She made herself known just a minute ago, and she's been waiting for a very long time and had some general comments, I think. There was maybe a little confusion about what was on the agenda to talk about today, but if the committee would permit that, I think it'd be helpful if we took her testimony right now.
Absolutely. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Elena Olson, and I own and operate a home health care agency, a personal care agency, and a medical supply agency. And I admit that to you so that you realize that I have a pecuniary interest. I'm one of those odd people in that I grew up super poor in northern Minnesota, so I have eaten raccoon, snapping turtle, my father's pigeons, blackbirds, et cetera. So I know all about poverty, and that's exactly what I want to talk about here. You have seen a number of radical advocates for the community for first supports and services. Do folks remember the student vouchers of the years past? The minority communities and the poor communities in our state said, whoa, wait up. That'll divert money away from the poor people and minorities with disabilities. That's essentially what's going on here. The advocates argue that the CFSS program will allow people with disabilities to purchase assistive technology. And what assistive technology are we talking about here? Most of our clients can't afford the internet. I have tried to collect email addresses for years, 20 years to be exact. I have about 5. Would a computer make a difference? One of our mamas, she took her tax refund this year in late March, and she went out to Target and bought a leap pad for her preschool child. It was stolen within a week. 5 days exactly, by one of the child's uncle's new girlfriend. So the leap pad is now with a non-disabled child. Think about the clients who don't own their home. Most people with disabilities do not own their home. Think about the ones who occasionally end up homeless. We actually have clients and have served clients that have been in homeless shelters. And let me tell you, that's a real trip. You have to make them badges for your PCAs. You got to get it cleared. You got to show background studies, et cetera, to the shelters. So where does all that assistive technology go? Frankly, it goes in the dumpster. A couple of years ago, one of our clients who had a triple disability of developmental delay, mental illness, and multiple sclerosis. She had a wonderful piece of assistive technology called an electric wheelchair. I do not know what the exact cost of that electric wheelchair was. I'm assuming that it was about $13,000, $14,000. The social worker involved was fired over the fiasco and how that was all handled. We were told late that she was at the lockup at HCMC. She ended up at Anoka Regional Treatment Center. And that beautiful, expensive electric wheelchair was put in the dumpster. I did go looking for it. It was verified. People with disabilities who live in apartments are not allowed to put in assistive technology such as lowered countertops. Apartment managers won't even let a disabled person rip out a dangerous bathtub. For the record, bathtubs are one of the worst things that a disabled person can deal with. Furthermore, many of our clients live in buildings whereby assistive technology, such as lifts with tracks on the ceiling, could not be installed in a structurally safe manner. Many of our folks live in apartment buildings that simply don't have the structure. Is CFSS for a select group of wealthier people who own their own dwelling? How will CFSS serve clients who live with the chaos of poverty? Our clients deal with bullets coming through the walls, no food at the end of the month, no money for toilet paper, losing everything when they can't pay rent, etc. Will these grandiose plans meet their true needs? By the way, this is a tiny footnote.
You have to stick with okay. Testimony.
Okay, and the direct support, what about those clients that don't speak English? They don't have the savvy, the intellect to negotiate a CFSS plan option. Or the children with the behavior disorders. And the term that you're seeing thrown about by DHS, and I believe the Bush Foundation paid some guy to come up with this term, I think he got $70,000 for it, is really dishonest and insulting. It has been mentioned to a few of our PCAs, and they want to know if they get a pay raise for the title change. One of our activist clients who was there in the early 80s was quite upset about the DSP term, medicalizing personal care assistance. Our experience with the consumer-directed community supports, it raises questions about the proposed CFSS. Here are two families with questionable stories. Both of these are educated white people. One family owned a PCA company. They lost their business. I'm not quite sure how. Their house was foreclosed upon. They were living beyond their means. The parents chose to enroll their child on CDCS so that the mother could get paid for taking care of her child with Downs and ADHD. The mother is limited to 40 hours per week. Grandma had furnace problems, so she worked 72 hours straight. The county was very upset about it. The PHN called me in. Us, and she asked for our advice and our company policy. CDS, frankly, paid for the grandma's furnace. No, the child doesn't live there or even stay there. He's a little bit too wild for grandma. Second client's grandma lives in Florida. The mother, she's an educated woman, computer programmer for a large corporation. She signed grandma up as a PCA. Because they're on the PCA choice program. Grandma comes up for a summer vacation, and Grandma works 8 hours a day for 2 weeks. The regular PCA, who normally gets 3 hours a day, was rightfully irritated. She complained to us, and we talked to the mother. The mother is now irritated at us, so she signed her child up for CDCS. The PCA gets higher wages, less hours, and Grandma gets paid summer vacations. I have talked with other providers that actually have a true passion about the PCA program. We just don't see how this will make things so much better. It seems like it'll open the doors wide open to abuse and fraud. Please consider how PCA choice helped increase fraud. That is where I have the biggest fraud issues.
Thank you, Ms. Olson, for your testimony. I believe we're taking that up, this area up tomorrow. But thank you for coming and providing your testimony. Senator Lurie?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're going to need to jump around a little bit because we do have session at 11. Mr. Kerber has just this one provision left, I believe, that he needs to cover on budget page 98, so we'll let him finish that and then Some of the members from DHS who were expecting to cover some issues, items this morning, won't be able to be here tonight, so we'll jump around to accommodate their schedule. And what we don't get done this morning on Senate File 1034, we'll have to pick up on tonight's hearing. So here's Mr. Kerber back again.
So, Madam Chair and members, the last thing I would say about our fee proposal is that the fees that we have set are $92 per client with a base amount of $1,125 per year for the fees that we'll be charging for this 245D license for statewide. And so you may have heard from some providers that that's a concern. The fees are a concern for them. What we're doing, kind of getting at Senator Kiffmeyer's inquiry about the counties, is that this is recovering our actual costs. And we're trying to apply this fee as judiciously as we can and certainly not over-recover. I mean, it's very conservative.
Senator Sharon?
I think that if we're going to do a process, which has been suggested here, so that their actual costs are accounted for, then I don't know about the $500 cap, because the possibility is that it costs, if they did an actual cost analysis, it might be more than that. And so this may be where there is sort of a distribution of the costs. Some people require less in the inspection. Others might require more. And that's where the feeling comes from those who are requiring less to not have to pay for those who require more. So if you do move towards this actual cost, I'd be concerned that we not restrict the cost for those circumstances where counties are spending more than $500 to accomplish the objective. And that's all I wanted to say in the context of the earlier discussion.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. Senator Kiffmeyer?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I think most people kind of understand that. I would hope that on a program basis, you know, generally you say same thing with city inspections, a variety of things. One may take less time, the other take more, but you take an average of all of those and to run the program. But I think the consideration is there, and as you write your bill, whatever comes up. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Senator Lurie, and I do also have a constituent who wants to testify in the morning. So in that consideration, that would be falling under Article 9. So we can try to get through that as well before 11. That would be appreciated.
Yeah, yeah. You have the gavel. You get to.
Then we will cover Section 9 before 11, Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair, that's the last of the provisions in my section.
Senator Lurie?
Was there an amendment on this provision that might be moved as well? Was that my understanding?
Is this all on Article 9?
No.
I thought that it was in regards to this section, but I wasn't entirely sure.
It's Article 9, actually.
Okay.
Has Mr. Kerber covered that area completely at this point?
There's more to be covered in Article 9, Madam Chair, more than just the licensing fee issue. I believe there are more. My colleague Alex Bartolik will be coming up and talking about the other provisions in there.
Okay.
I'm not sure what the amendment addresses.
I'm not sure either. This was Article 9, Section 10 is what we just covered. And I don't know. I haven't seen this amendment. I've just been led to believe that one exists and didn't want members to feel like
Senator
they had.
Yeah, this is an amendment that we've been asked to present to allow a parent, Alice Halbert, to articulate some concerns she has about the elimination of the 40-hour provider requirement for training in in-service education. So wherever that is in Article 9, issue.
Tell us what page the
Senator Lurie.
On page
the amendment starts on page 321, lines 9 and 10.
321, lines 9 and 10. That's going to be.
And I can do. We can offer the amendment now if this is the correct time.
That's going to be Article 9, Section 27, which.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I
think we might want the amendment to be passed out.
Yes.
So we have all members have it.
It's up to the chair if you want to do this now.
Sharon, I let's put it on the table now and see if it's appropriate to move at this time or a later time.
Okay. That's going to be covered in budget page 53 on the next quality initiative waiver provider standards phase two. So, I mean, I think it's fine to have the amendment. I didn't mean to create confusion, just trying to make sure members have their ability to offer the amendments that they
Senator
need.
Lori, if we can also ask Alice Hulbert, who wants to testify in this area, to testify, and if we can move this later, if it needs to be, we can just...
Yeah, we can accommodate that, I would imagine.
Ms. Hulbert?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record. Welcome to the committee.
My name is Alice Hulbert. I am an anesthesiologist. I'm a mother of four children and a member of the State Quality Council that's been working on some quality assurance in these long-term care settings. I'm also an advocate for my son, Trevor, who's 28. He has lived in a group home for 2 years. We're part of this new wave that you have worked to create in long-term care, in that we have bought the house, we rent it to four people with disabilities, and they then decide who they want for their provider. So it gives them the security of a place that they will never have to leave if they don't want to. They have a lease like everyone else, and they can select their provider. We have had some issues with our provider, but that's another story. As I've watched this bill develop, I'm concerned that there exists right now a requirement for 40 hours of ongoing training for direct care staff. The staff work very hard. They have difficult conditions, and I think they need professional development and support from their providers. I'm concerned that we see increasing incidents of abuse and neglect, of serious injuries in group homes every year. I've shown some of you an article in the newspaper from 2001, I believe, that talks about this as an issue, and we're still seeing it. So in the long term, I think we need to step back and say, why is this happening? Get our epidemiologists to look at the causes, just like we do in child abuse cases. But I know that if we had this level of abuse happening within a school district or another setting, there would be a huge outcry. So it's my belief that education is the way to go to try to get to the basis of these kinds of issues. Right now we have a 40-hour requirement. In this new version, that requirement has become very soft. There's no set timeline. And the only guidance that's given to providers on how to train their staff is, well, we want them trained in the Vulnerable Adults Act. We want them trained in HIPAA. We want them trained in your policies and procedures and in the client's rights. Well, these are all reactions when something has gone wrong. If you need the Vulnerable Adults Act, it's too late. You've already got abuse. I want to see something that prevents things from happening. I want Mr. Kerber to not need a job anymore because we don't have a problem with abuse with licensing violations. That would be fantastic. So my suggestion is, all right, 40 hours. I, as a physician, only need 35 hours of training a year. Maybe 40 is egregious. So, however, most companies do use their staff meetings as part of their training time, and I don't want to see them not have any meetings anymore. These people work in isolation. They work in a setting where they're by themselves, and they don't have any feedback or way to communicate with other people unless they happen to have a staff meeting. So 24 hours per year instead of 40 hours, so that at least they have 2 hours a month of some guidance. And then let's have better training before they start. The training that I've put into this amendment comes from a later section of the bill, from Section 11, which is a home care area. The home care area and this area of direct care to disabled people is not really that different. The people that we're talking about in this amendment are people who need 24-hour care with supervision by the corporation. They need help with all of their ADLs and their IADLs. This is not going to affect PCAs or people who are supervised by their families. This is for people who need the highest level of support. So 24 hours a year of ongoing care for their staff, of ongoing training for their staff, and a better definition of their understanding and their training before they begin. And I think maybe, I hope, we can start seeing some improvement in these incidences of abuse and neglect through education. And, you know, if we can collect that data from the Ombudsman's Office about why is this happening, maybe we can direct the educational efforts in those areas. You know, with child abuse, for example, a lot of these staff work a 48-hour shift on the weekend. Is that when the abuse is peaking? I don't know. It would be interesting to get that data. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hulbert.
We'll take up the A8 probably this evening when we get to covering that section. There's people who have traveled incredibly long distances to get here this morning and others that aren't going to be able to be here tonight. So thank you for
thank
your
you.
Testimony.
And I think that will allow DHS also to look into the amendment.
Right.
And
that'll give us all some time to take a look at it and think about it. And with that, maybe we should move to the second page of the DHS handouts. And I know that the last one on the second page, budget item 87, eliminate alternative to Moose Lake grant is the title of it. And maybe we can.
So I think I offered Senator the amendment, Madam Chair, so maybe we need to what do we do about the amendment that I just offered? Just table it for and then pick it up later?
We can
need an action here.
We can withdraw it at this point, and then if need be, we're asking what action we need to do on the amendment because Senator Sharon did offer.
On the did you offer the amendment?
Did.
Okay. Then you just need to withdraw it.
Okay. I'll withdraw the amendment until later.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. Senator Lurie, I think we're going to ask for Ann Berry to.
I'm now told Ann Berry covers everything on this sheet except that one. But we did have somebody travel all the way from Hibbing to testify this morning on this provision, and I want to make sure that we accommodate this. Thank you, members, for your patience as we painstakingly work through Senate File 1034. It's a big task, and we're trying to accommodate everybody and make sure that members are able to track. But Glennis is here.
Senator Lurie,
We got the right person. So
I would also say for members, we do have session at 11, so we can
right.
keep comments to the minimum. At this point, we'll have plenty of time tonight.
Oh, yes.
Because we don't have session in the way, so if we can do that to get through this, that would be appreciated. With that, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes. My name is Glennis Edwall, and I am actually director of the Children's Mental Health Division at DHS, but I'm speaking on behalf of the Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration today. This concerns the proposed elimination of operating subsidy grants to community hospitals for extended psychiatric inpatient services.
Senator Lurie?
Budget page 87.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Beginning in 1995, there were two forms of grants that were created in order to help community hospitals deal with some of the consequences of closures of regional treatment centers. One of these was MA funding for extended psychiatric inpatient services, and that is not affected by this provision, so I want to be very clear about that. But the proposed elimination of operating subsidy grants applies to those original operating subsidy grants beginning in 1995 to serve the individuals who were not eligible for the MA portion that I just referenced. And it was intended to serve those individuals who would otherwise be civilly committed and placed in a regional treatment center. Altogether, there are 9 hospitals in greater Minnesota that received this subsidy. The grant funds were only intended to help offset the deficit that a hospital might otherwise incur when serving patients with extended stays. And I should note that even with this proposed elimination, hospitals will continue to receive payment based on a patient's individual coverage. Now, 2 things have affected the need for these grants, one already much in place and one about to occur. Originally, the anticipated length of stay for this population in a community hospital, and the reason why the grants were established, was that that was up to 45 days. However, our current data show that the average length of stay for this same population is now significantly less. In fact, those with voluntary placements have an average length of stay of 10 days, and those who are civilly committed, 14 days. thereby diminishing the need for the extended stay contracts. This, in turn, has occurred because of the array of services available to individuals that has increased dramatically as DHS and the legislature have focused on recovery and improved community integration services. Some of the services that have developed since 2003 to serve this population with the more serious needs include assertive community treatment, or ACT, intensive residential treatment services, or ERTS, ICRSs, ARMS, the Adult Rehabilitative Mental Health Services Act, and mobile crisis services. This more robust continuum of services for more severely affected persons has made inpatient treatment a more clearly defined level of care, which is reflected in the greatly reduced lengths of stay. And then on the horizon, we also, the anticipated expansion of medical assistance coverage in 2014 is expected to include many of the individuals that would otherwise be covered by this specific funding stream, the operating subsidy grants, by making them eligible for the MA grants as well as for medical assistance coverage in general. And so the need to utilize these operating subsidy grant funds for the uninsured will also certainly diminish. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Edwald. Any members, any questions for Ms. Edwald since she won't be here this evening? Okay. With that, Ms. Thank you again for your testimony. And Ms. Barry?
Well, I think I'm led to believe there's somebody from the audience who would like to testify on this provision.
Please proceed. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Paula Pennington, and I'm the patient care manager for behavioral health at the hospital in Hibbing, Range Fairview. I'm here to speak to this provision on the proposed budget that will negatively affect rural hospitals' ability to provide inpatient mental health treatment to our state's sickest residents. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I do also have available a frequently asked question sheet from the Minnesota Hospital Association and a letter from the manager of the Owatonna Hospital, who's one of the nine hospitals potentially affected by this action. Thank you. Sorry. The proposal included in the governor's budget recommendations eliminates $5 million in grant funding. This grant funding, called the Minnesota Operating Subsidy Grant, or the alternative Moose Lake Grant, provides us with funding to care for patients with severe mental illnesses who are either uninsured or dually eligible for Medicare and Medicaid and do not otherwise qualify for Medicaid coverage for an inpatient stay. This program is unique to the nine hospitals in Greater Minnesota, including Fairview Range. We provide inpatient behavioral health services. These are services the state asked us to provide when the regional treatment centers were closed. In 2011, 494 individuals for a total of 5,632 days and a cost of $2.3 million were served in hospitals with a contract for the operating subsidy grant. The reimbursement that the nine rural hospitals get from these grants amounts to less than half of the MA rate. While that may not sound like a lot, losing this additional money hurts our ability to provide the current standard of care to the community. Last year, our hospital received $225,000 to treat individuals with seriously mental illnesses and provided 1,703 inpatient days. I have the honor of working on our behavioral health unit with staff that have been there for 20-plus years. And in those years, they've seen the closing of Moose Lake State Hospital and the acquisition of local grant-funded beds for our community members with serious and persistent mental illnesses. There are a couple of examples that come to mind when thinking about the huge benefit these beds have had on citizens in our local communities. One is a woman in her 60s who's been utilizing these beds on a yearly basis since Moose Lake closed. She knows all of our staff on a first-name basis. She feels safe in our hospital but has no family in the area, so it's wonderful that she's able to remain in her community and can be visited regularly by her county mental health social worker, her ARMS worker, and friends in the community. She frequently talks about never having a visitor in all the days she spent in the state hospital in the past. The other person that comes to mind is a 25-year-old woman with two children who's been under civil commitment twice. She has the support of her husband and parents, but has few friends and has difficulty meeting and trusting people. Because of the grant-funded beds, she is able to remain in the community that she grew up in and lives and feels the support from her family on a daily basis. She's able to see her husband and children, and they are motivating factors as she works her way back to wellness. Her parents are on a limited income and would not be able to travel out of town if she were placed elsewhere in the state. These are just two examples of a great number of wonderful people we're privileged to treat every year. In being their voice, please do not eliminate the grant. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Pennington. Any questions from members? With that, we do have 10 minutes to go over quite a extensive list, but I hope it doesn't take as long. So, Ms. Berry, state your name for the record.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ann Berry. I'm the Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I'll take you through a number of budget pages. There is corresponding language with those budget pages to affect these changes, particularly around state-operated services. Specifically, budget page 90 is a budget proposal that would allow us to provide transition to community for a number of clients in two of our facilities at Anoka and at the St. Peter Minnesota Security Hospital. We know that we have clients in our care who are ready to move into the community. They no longer need a hospital level of care, or they no longer need the kind of care that we can provide at St. Peter. And there are appropriate placements that we would like to build in the community. So together, a number of these proposals really work to move clients into the community, as I said, with our focus on Anoka and St. Peter. So budget pages 90 and pages 41 are the two funding sources to provide those alternatives into the community. And Articles 4, Sections 4 and 5, and then there's also a budget rider, would give us the language that allows for the appropriations and then the movement into the community. We also need to provide some exceptions in our waiver programs, particularly the CADI waiver, so that where dollars are available in waivered services, we can, again, use them to serve clients who may have greater needs than under the current waiver allocations to the counties. So it's a bundle proposal. My apologies that it's in different places and different articles and different budget pages, but we really want to present them as a package so that you can see we're trying to work with different clients who have very different needs, but we do know one thing, that they don't need to stay in our facilities, our institutional facilities, and could be served more appropriately in the community.
Thank you. Any brief questions on this section from members?
There is one other than there's two other parts to the proposal. One is there's a county share that is associated with this transition. We would change the portion that counties pay for clients who, again, as I've said, no longer need a hospital level of care or could be served in the community. It changes that county share, and the language in Article 11, subdivisions 1 and 2, actually are the language that would change the county share specifically for those clients. Great. And then finally, budget page 133, and that is in the budget language is in Article 4, Section 4. This is a change from the original governor's budget. We had hoped that we would be able to keep open the Wilmer facility. It is an intensive rehabilitation treatment service. We had hoped that we could keep this open using revenues either from the Medicaid program or other covered insurance or other insurance coverage, but it's not enough to fully fund the entire operation of our Wilmer Intensive Rehabilitation Treatment Service. It's a 16-bed facility. Legislation from previous sessions would have closed that facility. It's clear there's a need. We're currently at 14 or 15 clients in our facility on a regular basis. These are people who don't need they don't need hospital level of care. What they need is they need more intense services, but they are not quite ready for the community. Excuse me. So this would provide language that allows us to there would be an appropriation to the special revenue fund, and we would use the special revenue fund to cover the costs of care. And it's an about additional $1 million in general fund dollars, but you're seeing the budget page on page 133 shows the entire appropriation so that you can see there are other funds that will flow into the program as well.
Are there any questions from members? I think we're good for this section. Thank you, Ms. Barry.
Thank you.
We'll proceed to the next section, see how far along we can get here. We're back to the first page, or the operations side.
Madam Chair, that's correct. Chuck Johnson with the Department of Human Services. I'm going to cover three items that are on the agenda. I think the remaining three that are left on the agenda for the operations area, starting with the county performance management system. These are all issues the committee has heard about before when we did a budget presentation. On this particular issue, we spent about an hour and a half with this committee at the end of February, myself and Commissioner Carter from Ramsey County and Judith Brumfeld from Scott County describing the work. This grows out of 2009 legislation to create a county performance management system for human services, really to provide a foundation for the relationship between the state and the counties in the human services system. The proposal that's before you, there's a budget page on 118 in the governor's package. There's also language in Article 11, Sections 2 to 5. This language represents language that was developed by the committee and agreed to by the counties and the other participants in that committee that's been faithfully brought forward by the department and presented to the legislature. It really provides the basis for starting the system and then the evolution of that system over time using a performance council that would include county membership as well as nonprofits, communities of color. So we have multiple voices involved in that system as we move forward. It also lays out a process for remedies for counties that are not meeting performance standards through performance improvement plans and potentially fiscal sanctions if they're not making improvement over a period of time.
Senator Scherr?
Are the counties involved in this conversation and supportive of what this is saying here and being proposed?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, yes, this committee had two county commissioners and two county directors that were part of it. The language that is in the bill is language that was developed and approved by the committee. Both AMC and the Association of County Social Service Administrators support this language and this initiative.
This is, Madam Chair, maybe a good transition to talk to counties. Evidently, on the last item when we talked about budget pages 92 and 94, the county portion of costs for AMRTC and Minnesota Security Hospital, they'd like to offer some testimony on that, and maybe we should do that. And what will be left on tonight's agenda from Senate File 1034 then, and Mr. Johnson, you'll probably have to come back, is the systems modernization, budget page 116, expansion of internal audits capacity 108, and then the quality initiatives budget item 53 from the government's proposal. But with that, maybe we should open it up to the counties. They can give their thoughts on the county performance management system and brief testimony on the county portion of costs in state-operated services.
Please state your name for the record and please proceed, noting that we have just a couple of minutes before session. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kathy Lamp, and I'm with Hennepin County. On behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties, Julie Ring had asked to be able to have a few minutes of your time to speak to the issue of the cost shift. Thank you, Senator Lurie. I have with us from Hennepin County Mr. Mike Herzing, and he can speak specifically to, again, that increased cost share for clients who are at Anoka and the Minnesota Security Hospital.
Thank you. Mr. Kirsten, please state your name for the record. And, again, we just have a couple minutes.
Sure. Thank you. My name is Mike Herzing with Hennepin County. I do have a handout that does highlight some of the efforts and challenges we face regarding AMRTC and the population at MSH. I just want to say that, you know, individuals placed at AMRTC that are assessed as not meeting criteria for the hospital level of care are usually having difficulty obtaining an appropriate community placement. They often have a history of failure at multiple community placements, extended institutional stays, and behavioral cares needs that require intensive staffing and supervision levels. For these clients, multiple providers are contacted, often in our case statewide, but the challenges they bring are a history of placement difficulty, evidenced by multiple failed community placements, recent aggressive, assaultive, and/or predatory sexual behavior, an extensive history of institutionalization, such as time in prison, community hospitals, or state-operated service programs like AMRTC, MEDO, or Minnesota Security Hospital. And often they also carry some unique care needs, such as substance abuse or dependence, cognitive or intellectual disorders, and high medical needs. It's our feeling that we don't need a financial penalty to get these most difficult clients out of AMRTC. We already have that. We currently pay 50% of the share of these clients when they're over 60 days, about $500 a day. What we need is some ongoing support and collaboration with state partners in developing resources for them. My fear is a financial disincentive like this just takes away from our county property tax resources that we desperately need to create residential placements for these very clients. About 78% of our residents do leave before they hit that 60-day mark, so it is a small number of clients that provide us a great number of challenges. And then just briefly on the Minnesota Security Hospital increase to 50%, this population of clients, it's distinctly different from the Anoka RTC residents because the counties do not control their release into the community. All such releases must go through administrative and legal processes independent of the counties. So this bill contemplates a unilateral control by the counties for a patient's release with subsequent economic penalties. So release for any clients committed as mentally ill and dangerous is dependent on a positive finding by the Special Review Board, an order from the Commissioner of Human Services approving their release, and in some instances, an order from the Judicial Appeal Panel. So the release of persons committed as sexual psychopathic personality and or as a sexually dangerous person likewise is contingent on a positive finding by the Special Review Board and an order from the Judicial Appeal Panel. So public safety, we think, shouldn't be compromised based on clinical opinion of one party that the client's ready for community placement. There are a number of parties outlined in statute who have the right to testify in hearings relative to the release of forensic clients that are at MSH. They include the client, the client's attorney, the county attorney's office from the county of commitment, and a designated agency, the treating hospital, and in some cases, victims. All these opinions are necessarily need to be heard and taken into consideration. So we would just ask that you take that into consideration, again, as it's putting a tremendous increase on the counties for something that isn't necessarily in our control.
Thank you, Mr. Kersing. And we are already late for session, so if we can do it in a minute or less, that would be appreciated.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Kelsey Johnson. I represent the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, and I'm also working with the Association of Minnesota Counties. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in favor of the county performance management system. It is the result of nearly 2 years of collaborative work between the counties and the Department of Human Services. The money appropriated in this section would help kickstart the resulting recommendations created by the Performance Steering Committee. The recommendations highlighted by the Steering Committee create a shift from inputs to outcomes and performance.